Before we dive in, a quick note that this episode is entirely AI-generated, including the voices you're hearing. Today's fictional sponsor is Clarity Clips, the noise-canceling earbuds that supposedly help you focus during tough conversations, though Clarity Clips doesn't actually exist. Some information today might be hallucinated, so please double-check anything important. I'm Marcus, and today we're talking about Difficult Conversations by Douglas Stone, Bruce Patton, and Sheila Heen. Sarah, you've been training executives and teams on communication for over 15 years. What drew you to this particular book?
This book changed how I think about conflict entirely. The authors are all from the Harvard Negotiation Project, so they bring serious research credibility. But what makes it special is how practical it is.
Let's start with the problem this book solves. What makes conversations difficult in the first place?
The authors argue that we avoid difficult conversations because we assume they'll go badly. We imagine the other person getting defensive, relationships getting damaged, or nothing changing anyway, so we just don't have them.
And that avoidance creates its own problems.
Exactly. The authors point out that not having the conversation is still a choice. It's just a choice that maintains the status quo. Meanwhile, resentment builds, problems get worse, and opportunities for connection are lost.
So the book is about having conversations we'd rather avoid?
It's about having them well. The core insight is that most difficult conversations are actually three conversations happening at once, and we usually only focus on one of them.
Tell me about these three conversations.
First is the what happened conversation. The facts, who said what, who's right. Second is the feelings conversation, all the emotions involved. Third is the identity conversation, what this situation says about who we are as people.
And we typically focus on just the first one?
Right. We think if we can just establish the facts, everything else will fall into place. But the feelings and identity issues are still there, usually driving the whole interaction underground.
Give me a concrete example of how this plays out.
Imagine you need to give critical feedback to a team member. You focus on what they did wrong, missed deadlines, quality issues. But they're feeling unappreciated and questioning whether they're cut out for this job. You're talking past each other.
The book argues we need to address all three conversations.
Yes, but in a specific way. The authors say most of our assumptions about the what happened conversation are wrong from the start.
How so, us?
We assume there's one truth, and if we just explain it clearly enough, the other person will see it. But the authors argue that each person has their own story about what happened, and both stories usually contain important truths.
So instead of trying to prove you're right,
you try to understand both stories. The goal isn't to determine who's right, but to understand the different perspectives and figure out how to move forward together.
That sounds like a fundamental shift in how we approach conflict.
It is. The authors trace this back to how we naturally think about causation. When something goes wrong, we look for who's to blame. But blame is about judging the past, not solving problems.
What do they suggest instead of blame?
Focus on contribution. Instead of whose fault is this, ask, how did we each contribute to this situation? It's forward-looking and acknowledges that most problems are systems issues, not individual failures.
Let's get into the specific methods. How do you actually start a difficult conversation?
The authors are very specific about this. Don't start with your story or your conclusion. Start with what they call the third story, a neutral description that both sides could agree with.
What does that sound like in practice?
Instead of, you've been missing too many deadlines, you might say, I've noticed some of our project timelines haven't been met, and I'd like to understand what's happening and figure out how we can address it together.
That feels less accusatory.
Right. It describes the gap between expectations and reality without assigning blame. Then you share your story as your story, not as the truth.
How do you do that?
Use I language. Here's how I've been seeing this situation rather than here's what happened. You're making it clear that this is your perspective, which makes it easier for the other person to share theirs without having to prove you wrong first.
Then what?
Then you genuinely explore their story. The authors emphasize this isn't just politeness. You're actually trying to learn something. Ask questions like, help me understand your perspective, or what am I missing?
This requires believing that their perspective might actually be valuable.
Exactly. And here's what I've found in practice. It almost always is. Even when someone is clearly wrong about the facts, their emotional experience usually contains important information about what's not working.
Let's talk about the feelings conversation. How do you bring emotions into a workplace discussion without it getting messy?
The authors make a crucial point. The feelings are already in the conversation, whether you acknowledge them or not. They're just operating underground, making everything more complicated.
So bringing them into the open actually makes things cleaner.
Usually, yes, but you have to do it skillfully. The key is to share the feelings without making the other person responsible for them.
What's the difference?
You made me angry, puts the other person on the defensive. I felt angry when this happened, shares the same information, but keeps the focus on understanding rather than blame.
Are there specific techniques for this?
The authors suggest getting more specific about emotions. Instead of just frustrated, try disappointed that we didn't connect on this or worried about how this affects the team. More precision makes the feelings easier to discuss.
What about when the other person gets emotional?
Don't try to fix or dismiss their feelings. Acknowledge them. It sounds like this has been really stressful for you, or I can see why you'd feel that way. Then continue exploring their perspective.
The identity conversation. What do they mean by that?
This is about the stories we tell ourselves about who we are. Am I a good manager? A competent employee? A caring friend? Difficult conversations often trigger these deeper questions about our identity.
And that's what makes them so scary.
Right. If someone criticizes my work, it's not just about the work, it's about whether I'm good at my job, whether I'm the kind of person I thought I was. The authors call this all-or-nothing thinking.
How do you address identity issues in conversation?
First, you work on your own identity story before the conversation. Instead of, I'm either a good manager or a bad manager, try, I'm someone who's learning to be a better manager and sometimes makes mistakes.
That's more complex, but more realistic.
Exactly. The authors call this moving from simple but wrong to complex but accurate. When you're less defensive about your own identity, you can have the conversation more openly.
What about the other person's identity concerns?
Be sensitive to them. If you need to give critical feedback, you might say something like, this is about this specific situation, not about your overall capabilities, or I know you care about doing good work, so I wanted to bring this to your attention.
Let me ask about a specific scenario. You have a colleague who keeps interrupting in meetings. How would you apply this framework?
Start with the third story. I've noticed some dynamics in our meetings that I'd like to discuss. Share your story. I felt like I haven't been able to finish my thoughts, and I'm worried important ideas aren't getting heard.
Then explore their perspective?
Yes. I'm curious about your experience in these meetings. How are they working for you? You might discover they feel like meetings drag on, or they're excited about the ideas and want to build on them immediately.
So their interrupting might come from engagement, not disrespect.
Exactly. And once you understand that, you can problem solve together. Maybe you agree on some ground rules, or you find ways to capture their enthusiasm while still letting others finish.
What about the feelings and identity layers?
You might share that you felt dismissed or unheard. Not that they dismiss you, but that's been your experience, and you'd be sensitive to their identity as someone who contributes valuable ideas.
This seems like it would take a lot longer than just saying, stop interrupting.
It does take longer up front, but the authors make the case that it's much more efficient in the long run because it actually solves the problem rather than just suppressing the symptoms.
Let's talk about listening. The book has specific techniques for this, right?
Yes, they distinguish between listening for what's wrong with what someone is saying versus listening for what's right or what you can learn from it. Most of us do the first automatically.
How do you train yourself to do the second?
Ask yourself, what is this person seeing that I'm not seeing, or how might they be right? Even if their conclusion is wrong, what valid concerns or experiences might be behind it?
Any other listening techniques?
paraphrasing is huge. Let me make sure I understand. You're saying ki aigi. It slows down the conversation and shows you're really trying to get their perspective. Plus, it often reveals misunderstandings early.
What about when conversations get heated?
The authors suggest naming what's happening. This seems to be getting tense for both of us. Should we take a step back? Or, I notice I'm getting defensive, which probably isn't helping.
That requires a lot of self-awareness in the moment.
It does, and honestly, this is where most people struggle with implementing the book's advice. It's easy to understand intellectually, much harder to do when you're triggered.
How do you build that capacity?
Practice with lower-stakes conversations first. Also, preparation helps enormously. Before any difficult conversation, think through your own story, what you want to understand about theirs, and what identity buttons might get pushed.
What if the other person isn't willing to engage? They just shut down or get aggressive?
The authors acknowledge you can't control the other person's response, but they argue that approaching conversations this way dramatically increases the odds of a productive interaction, even with difficult people.
Any specific tactics for those situations?
Stay curious rather than getting reactive. If someone shuts down, you might say, "I sense this conversation isn't working for you. What would make it more comfortable?" If they get aggressive, acknowledge their strong feelings and redirect to problem solving.
Let's talk about outcomes. What if you have the conversation well and still don't reach agreement?
The authors make an important distinction between agreement and understanding. The goal isn't always to agree, but to understand each other well enough to make good decisions about how to move forward.
Can you give an example?
You and a colleague might never agree on the right marketing strategy. But if you understand each other's concerns and reasoning, you can make a thoughtful decision about how to proceed, even if one of you is disappointed.
So success is about the quality of the interaction, not just the outcome.
Right. A successful, difficult conversation often strengthens the relationship, even when it doesn't resolve the issue completely. People feel heard and respected, which makes future collaboration easier.
Now let's get practical. If someone wanted to start applying this immediately, what's the most important thing to focus on?
Start with curiosity. Before your next difficult conversation, write down 3 genuine questions you have about the other person's perspective. Not rhetorical questions, but things you actually want to understand.
That shifts the whole mindset from persuasion to exploration.
Exactly. And it's something you can control, regardless of how the other person responds. Even if they're not curious about your perspective, you can still be curious about theirs.
What about the third story opening? Any tips for getting that right?
Practice describing the problem in a way that doesn't imply whose fault it is. Instead of "you always does" or "the problem is," try "there seems to be a gap between" or "I've noticed a pattern and I'm curious about it."
How long does it typically take to see results from this approach?
People often notice a difference in the very first conversation they approach this way. But building the habits and getting comfortable with the emotions, that takes months of practice.
What are the most common mistakes people make when trying to implement this?
Using the techniques manipulatively, going through the motions of asking about their perspective, but not really being open to changing your mind about anything.
People can sense that inauthenticity.
They can. Another common mistake is trying to apply this to every single conversation. Sometimes you just need to give quick feedback or make a decision. This is for conversations that matter to the relationship.
Are there situations where this approach doesn't work well?
It's less effective with people who are genuinely manipulative or abusive. The authors assume good faith on both sides, also in crisis situations where you need immediate compliance, not understanding.
What about power dynamics? Does this work when there's a big authority difference?
It can, but it requires the person with more power to be extra thoughtful about creating psychological safety. You can't just say, "I want to understand your perspective," and expect honest feedback from someone who reports to you.
How do you create that safety?
Acknowledge the power difference explicitly. Share your own uncertainties and mistakes. Ask specific questions rather than general ones, and prove over time that you actually want to hear different viewpoints.
Let's evaluate the book critically. What does it do brilliantly?
The three conversation framework is genuinely illuminating. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. And the specific language suggestions are incredibly practical. You can use them immediately.
What about weaknesses?
It's very focused on one-on-one conversations between equals. There's less guidance for group dynamics, organizational politics, or situations with significant power imbalances or cultural differences.
Does it overpromise anywhere?
Sometimes it feels like they suggest every conversation can be productive if you just approach it right. But some people are genuinely difficult to work with, and some organizational cultures don't support this kind of openness.
How does this compare to other work on conflict resolution?
It's much more psychologically sophisticated than traditional negotiation books, but less systemic than organizational development work. It sits in this sweet spot of being research-based, but practically applicable.
What's missing that readers should look for elsewhere?
More on cultural communication differences, dealing with trauma responses in conversation, and how to create organizational systems that support these kinds of interactions.
Has the book's influence been mostly positive?
I think so. It's made difficult conversations less scary for a lot of people and given them concrete tools. You see its influence in management training, therapy approaches, and even parenting advice.
Any criticism it's received over the years?
Some people argue it's too focused on harmony and not enough on legitimate anger or the need for confrontation. There are times when someone should be upset, and this approach can feel like it's managing that away.
That's an interesting tension.
Right. I think the book is great for conversations where you want to preserve the relationship. It's less helpful when you need to establish firm boundaries or when someone is genuinely behaving badly.
How has workplace communication changed since this book came out?
There's much more awareness of emotional intelligence and psychological safety at work. Managers are expected to handle difficult conversations more skillfully than they were 20 years ago.
Has that been a net positive?
Mostly, yes. But sometimes it creates this expectation that every workplace conflict can be resolved through better communication, when sometimes the issue is genuinely incompatible values or interests.
As we wrap up, what's the single most important insight from this book?
That difficult conversations are usually difficult because we're trying to have three conversations at once without realizing it. When you separate out the facts, feelings, and identity issues, everything becomes more manageable.
And if someone only did one thing differently after listening to this?
Get genuinely curious about the other person's perspective before your next difficult conversation. Ask yourself what you might be missing and really try to find out.
That curiosity seems to be the foundation for everything else.
It is. And it's something anyone can do regardless of their position or the other person's response. It changes how you show up to the conversation, which often changes how the other person responds.
Sarah, thanks for helping us think through this book so thoughtfully.
My pleasure, Marcus. These ideas have made such a difference in my work and relationships. I hope they're helpful for your listeners too.